Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Change is in the air. Kids heading back to school. Americans enjoying the last throes of summer. Congress begins a new session tomorrow, and President Obama relaunches his health care reform push with a speech in Cincinnati today at an AFL-CIO picnic. We haven't pitched a no-hitter. That's how White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs described the administration's success in this summer of division and disinformation. Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News and author of the network's blog, The Note. Rick, let's start with health care. Even conservative health policy experts are reportedly upset that their concerns about the cost of health care have been overshadowed by false claims of death panels and genocide. So what is the president going to try to do this week to counter that disinformation?
He's been spending so much time saying what's not in the bill that he needs to change the terms of the debate to give Democrats something to sell proactively. The big challenge at his speech Wednesday is to start to lay out what he is for, and most importantly, I think, what is going to work and what is not going to work for him with Congress, because we are down to the late innings, to use the baseball analogy that Robert Gibbs embraced.
Well, even Senators Mike Enzi of Wyoming and Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who are two of the three Republicans working on a health care compromise on a key committee, are, as recently as this past week, saying that either the government bureaucrats will determine end-of-life issues or that the plug will be pulled on grandma, neither of which are in any of the proposals, but that thinking has taken hold. So with those two key players still saying that, is there any hope of a compromise?
Almost none. The efforts of the administration now are geared at only getting one Republican, Olympia Snowe of Maine. They're really trying to tailor the bill so that she'll be on it to give it at least the patina of bipartisanship. There's other procedural things they can do to make it pass if it comes to that, but there's still a hope, I think, in the next 24 to 48 hours of some kind of a breakthrough, but I don't think anyone at the White House seriously thinks that the committee is going to provide the bipartisanship that they've been looking for.
Well, then the White House has to also deal this week with a disinformation campaign about the president's planned speech to school kids tomorrow. Florida Republican Party Chair Jim Greer said last week that it was appalling that taxpayer dollars were being used to spread the president's socialist ideology. Now, the White House made it clear they only want to talk to kids about staying in school, but that thinking that it was going to be about socialism took hold. What can the White House do here?
Well, they're going to be putting the text out a day early so that teachers and parents get a chance to take a look at it. The idea of the president speaking to school children is not new. It's been going on for decades. The fact that he's getting attacked for this, it just says something about the hyper-politicized environment that we're in.
Well, and others would say, again, it goes back to the campaign of disinformation. Well, the White House also has to contend this week with the over-the-weekend resignation of Van Jones. He was the Green Jobs czar, who, as a community activist, called Republicans a bad word and signed a petition to investigate a government role in 9/11. How much of a stumble is this for the White House?
I see a couple of discrete problems with this. One is you lose this important voice inside the White House.
Because his comments in the past aside, Van Jones has been one of the biggest proponents of green jobs, especially for the inner city.
That's right. And so you lose that voice. I think he was also very important to liberals. There's been a lot of liberals that have been upset about the pace of change in the Obama administration. The fact that Van Jones was on the inside gave them some hope. And I think the broader problem is that he's not going to be the last Obama administration official who is targeted by the right wing. The fact that the White House wasn't able to withstand the pressure around this, it may embolden some of the president's critics.
Rick Klein, senior political reporter for ABC News, author of the network's blog, The Note. And Rick, we wish you well this Labor Day.
Thank you so much.
Well, now let's briefly check in with Congressman Keith Ellison, a Democrat of Minnesota. What does he want to hear from the president? But first, Congressman, what are you hearing from your constituents on this last day before heading back to D.C.?
Well, I heard that we really need it. You know, so many people drop because of a pre-existing condition. So many people put in a financial ruin, even when they had health insurance, because of being underinsured. So many people who've seen their premiums double in the last 10 years. You know, we spend more on health care than any country in the world. I believe that once we get savings in place and once we begin to benefit from having a large national pool, that savings really will accrue. I mean, the fact is people are a little nervous. There has been a concerted and deliberate misinformation campaign out there, which we've had to sort through. But the fact is, once you sit down and talk to people about what's really going on with most people, with questions, you can get bored.
Well, but as we've been hearing, that may not happen in Congress. What do you think should happen if there's not a bipartisan agreement?
we should pass a bill. The Senate should use its budget reconciliation authority and then pass a bill.
This is the ability to pass a bill with a majority vote of 51 rather than 60 votes.
I'm told that Medicare did pass without any Republican votes. Even earlier this year, we passed the stimulus package without any Republican votes. We may have to go forward in the best interest of the American people without any Republican votes, and I'm very comfortable with that. You know, the fact is that major nation-changing historic legislation has always come with a certain degree of rancor. You know, the civil rights movement and the legislation that came with it came with a lot of controversy, and so did women's rights legislation. Social Security had its detractors, yet Americans wouldn't abandon it today. So I think that, you know, we need to take a page from the last election. The Democrats did win it, and we should act like we won it and pass the agenda that the American people voted us in to pass.
Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, out to a Labor Day picnic on Boone Island, did you say?
That's right. It's a great place.
Right there in Minnesota.
Fun.
Well, enjoy your Labor Day, Congressman Ellison, and thank you.
Thank you.
So Boone Island in Minneapolis, it's on the Mississippi River, which, did you know, is fed by a kettle pond. That's right. Beautiful Lake Itasca in Minnesota is the spring-fed source of the Mississippi, and it's a kettle pond. So are Walden and Wobegon. One real, the other lives in our imagination.
Each kettle is interesting in its own way. Long Island's Lake Ronkonkoma resembles a bright blue meteorite impact crater smack dab in the suburbs. Pennsylvania's Lake Labouf was visited by George Washington when he was a young soldier in British uniform during the run-up to the French and Indian War. Maine's Schoodick Lake was visited by Jefferson Davis, soon to be president of the Confederacy, just before the Civil War. Some thought he was on a spy mission. Boot Lake in Elkhart, Indiana, is arguably America's most volatile kettle, having gone from swimming pond to illegal dump to sludge farm to environmental education center within the span of a century. Kettle Lake, North Dakota, was an important oasis for migrating waterfowl 6,000 years ago when the climate was drier, perhaps an omen of things to come in our steadily warming world.
That's Robert Thorson reading from his fascinating book, Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle Lakes and Ponds. And since so many Americans are in them today, we've invited this professor of geology at the University of Connecticut to tell us more about them. And Professor Thorson, we know from your book that kettle ponds were formed by the meltdown of blocks of glacial ice. A basin shaped like a cooking kettle is formed. And if that basin is deep enough to intersect the water table, then you have a spring-fed kettle pond. But what else makes them special? You know, you travel the country looking for them this summer. Why?
It sounds ironic, but one of the things that makes them so special is their unspecialness. There's probably 100,000 of them between Maine and Montana, and they are family-friendly lakes. They're wonderful places to get away from it all because they're not only many of them, but they're sort of chaotic in their distribution. And so you can leave the city and be gone probably no more than half an hour and find yourself in a fairly random gravel road with a little lake at the end of it.
Well, and you tell us everything anyone's ever wanted to know about kettle ponds. We get deep into the science of limnology, which is the study of lakes. Who knew, for instance, that pollen is considered the sperm of the vegetable kingdom? And pollen scientists call lake muck, that stuff at the bottom, yitya?
Yitya.
It's a Swedish word. You take us through the history of kettle ponds, important in American history at every phase, starting with the Pilgrims.
I was very surprised to find that the first freshwater experience in this settled part of the country came from kettle ponds on the outer Cape Cod. Miles Standish and his party headed off in search of the Indians they were following, and they became very, very thirsty, and they ended up quenching their thirst at a kettle pond using a kettle from one of the Indian middens or burial mounds.
And then kettle ponds went on to provide not just water, but hay that grew on the edges for the livestock, bog iron ore, cranberries.
Cranberries were really big, and most of those are from kettles.
Ice harvesting, the beautiful clear water from the kettle pond.
Yes.
But beyond that, you think the most important thing that came from New England kettles in particular was a greater appreciation of nature. They launched transcendentalism in the early 1800s, a cluster of ponds here in Massachusetts. As you write, every basin filled with what was holy water to transcendentalists. Tell us more about that.
The attachment of transcendentalism to nature happened directly over the so-called Lake District in Concord and Sudbury and Lincoln, Massachusetts. And when the English or the Europeans would talk about a lake district, they would mean spectacular scenery, mountain scenery. But when the Emersonian transcendentalists were looking for a lake district, they found little things like Walden Pond and Flint's Pond.
We're all, of course, talking about Ralph Waldo Emerson and,
yes,
and then Henry David Thoreau, of course, who lived in his little shack, actually visited his little shack on the edge of Walden Pond. You remind us they didn't really live there full time. But what did he see in the Kettle Pond, Walden?
I think the easiest way to answer that question is just to read a word that I used in the epigraph of the book, and it's the word I. And here's his quote. "A lake is the landscape's most beautiful and expressive feature. It is Earth's eye, looking into which the beholder measures the depth of his own nature." Now, that could not have been written about most kinds of lakes, but it can be written about a kettle pond, which tend to be fairly steep-walled and, by virtue of their small size, set low in the woods and their steep banks, do really unusual things with temperature inversions, with sound. The acoustics of kettle lakes are different. And so the reasons that Thoreau was drawn to Walden Pond are the same reasons that made it what he called a deep blue well.
Well, and we here have been to Walden Pond. People across the country, I'm thinking Wisconsin, Minnesota, you name just about every kettle pond in the country. They've been to their kettle ponds. They know what you're talking about, that sound of you can be all the way a quarter of a mile on the other side and you can hear
voices
bounce across. But it's not exactly an eye anymore. It's something of a cloudy eye. What has happened to kettle ponds?
One of the problems is that all small lakes in general are subject to nutrient pollution. What happens is that we need nutrient. I mean, human beings need nutrient in order to function and survive. But if we get too much, we become obese and there's all kinds of health problems. So the problem is not in the nutrient that we eat. It's in the amount that we get. And kettle lakes are normally fairly low in their nutrient because they're surrounded by sand and gravel and that they don't have rivers running into them bringing nutrient. So they tend to be clean. But when they are settled, they are vulnerable to pollution because the nutrient can modify that clean state very easily.
So people suddenly, as you write there, there was a time in American history when suddenly it was between two wars, World Wars I and II, when Americans started to get a little more recreation and started to go to the lakes for respite, more and more people than just the intellectuals around Walden Pond, started with little shacks that didn't really hurt anything, but then suddenly, as
That's
you
right.
write, are rolling out new lawns with fertilizer. What else was happening?
Well, they were receptacles for waste. People just threw whatever they could in low spots in the ground. They didn't understand the groundwater connection.
Well, and to be frank, these ponds also became receptacles of waste because people swimming in them are, you know, wetting in them, adding nutrient, so to speak. But also, as you said, the ground table's all connected. So what you do in one area affects a kettle pond in another in the groundwater. Robert Thorson's book is Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle Lakes and Ponds. After a break, finding the real version of the fictional kettle pond Lake Wobegon. Also later today, is texting making kids less literate? Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Walden Pond here in Massachusetts was a busy place yesterday. We finally made it across the lake and back, a total of a mile swim, big summer achievement, but elsewhere, kids playing, people sunning, a very special place, a kettle pond. As we're hearing in our conversation with Robert Thorson, a geology professor at the University of Connecticut, his book is Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle Lakes and Ponds. Professor, tell us about your personal connection to kettle ponds. Your family lived on, was it Union Lake?
Lake Union in western Minnesota, where I was raised as a kid, and I fit the profile of the summer cottage culture kid that just rambled around the shores unencumbered for days and maybe even weeks at a time, however much we could. My parents were both from the upper Midwest, and yet we found ourselves wandering around Wisconsin and Illinois. But every summer we went back up to a cottage purchased by my grandfather for $500 in 1928. And that's where the taproot of lake culture was planted in my father and in my family, and it carried on from there.
And what are some of the things you did on lakes?
Oh, almost everything. I mean, just swimming, wrestling, playing, catching frogs, fishing, tubing, trolling for big fish.
In the winter?
Water skiing, yeah.
In the winter, lake would freeze over and you and your friends would figure out how many times you could make a car spin.
Yeah, I see you found that quote.
Yes,
what we did was I remember my buddy had an old 57 Chevy and we would just crank that thing up as fast as we could on the lake and then turn the wheel and step on the brake and see how many times we could spin it.
Yeah, so... And by the way, we're not recommending that.
No, not anymore.
But that kind of carefree culture, first of all, you'd think twice about, you know, people would dump cars in lakes. You'd think twice about
that
today.
Oh, yeah, they just dump them, yes.
And you go back to Lake Union, and it's as you write, it's sort of a bouldered up kettle now.
About half of the lake still looks decent. It's pretty much okay. They were mostly the wild rice marshes on the other side. But the bay that I remember the most is boulder-sided. People have taken out the marshes. They have steepened the shore. They've carved little places for boats. They've lined the whole thing with boulders. And it just strikes me as very sterile and very noisy.
But is that bad for the lake's health?
Well, it's not bad for the property owner who wants to make sure that their chem lawn goes straight to the edge of the water so they can go right from their bare feet into the water skiing boat. It's not bad, but it is very bad and destructive for the natural lake ecosystem. We now realize that the wetlands that fringe the lakes are an extremely important part of keeping the lake clean.
Yeah. Now, we said Lake Wobegon lives in our imagination. Garrison Keillor's only made sort of reference to where it might actually be. He, of course, grew up, you know, with lakes and kettle ponds. But where is Lake Wobegon?
Lake Wobegon is actually there in the middle of Mist County in central Minnesota. But it's not on the map, he says, because the surveyors made a mistake. So he deliberately hid the lake somewhere. But he tipped his hand in 2002. In a photo essay book, he said that the most Wobegonic town is Holdingford, Minnesota. So I went and looked into that. And Holdingford, Minnesota is in the right place, in central Minnesota near the headwaters of the Sauk River. But there's no lake there. So the nearest town with a good-sized lake where the main street is against the lake is a lake called Middle Spunk Lake. And that is my stand-in for Lake Wobegon. And, in fact, on the July 4th celebration this year, Garrison Keillor held a free show and broadcast from the shore of Middle Spunk Lake.
Aha!
So when I was there, I got some water out of Middle Spunk Lake to bring back to Walden. And guess what I did when I was there? I took Walden water and poured it into Wobegon. Because what I'm trying to do is just let these lakes get to know each other a little bit in reality of chemistry.
Well, by the way, you've been between Walden and this fictional, maybe, Lake Wobegon. But Thoreau also made trials.
Yes, yes.
What did he do?
Thoreau developed what was called consumption, tuberculosis. He was quite ill. And before that, he was writing in his journal all the time. He was writing. But once he became ill, he sort of fell off writing his journal. And he was ill enough that his doctor advised him to go find a different climate to be in for a while. And this was typical practice of the day. But think of the places. He was advised maybe to go to the West Indies. Maybe he could go up to the mountains. Maybe he could go out to the desert. He took a very unusual decision, and he went to Minnesota. And I wondered why until I actually was there this summer, and I looked at Lake Calhoun with new eyes. Thoreau, in his only trip out of the Northeast, basically got on the train, then got on the steamer, got out at Minneapolis, which was then a town not a whole lot bigger than Concord was in its heyday. And the first thing he did was went straight to the nearest kettle pond, which looked very, very Walden-like. It's called Lake Calhoun. And there he did the same thing he did here. You know, he just swam around. He sort of botanized. He smelled the pine-scented air. He just hung out at kettle ponds for a week or two trying to recover his health. And I wondered if if he wasn't trying to follow his doctor's advice to actually go get some different air, but yet stay near the thing he loved the most, which was Walden Pond.
Right. Did you dab some of that water that's before us on your forehead?
Well, until it runs out, I'm going to offer it to anybody if they want to touch their forehead with it. I don't see why organized, established religions should have a claim on all symbolism.
Well, so. And people back in the day, they wanted to be baptized in Walden's
water. Well, that's a quote straight from Nathaniel Hawthorne. He said, "I would love to be baptized in Walden Pond. It's clear and beautiful like usual." He said, "But then I would not want to wash my sins off into it."
As we have done.
As we have done.
Since then. That's Robert Thorson, professor of geology at the University of Connecticut. His book is Beyond Walden, The Hidden History of America's Kettle Lakes and Ponds. We'll link you to his blog about his trip to see kettles from Maine to Montana. That'll be at our website, hereandnow.org. Professor, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, tomorrow we'll leave Walden Pond as Washington goes back to work. Hillary the movie heads back to the Supreme Court. The High Court will hold an unusual September session to reconsider the campaign finance case that film accrued. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Joyce Maynard's new coming-of-age novel, Labor Day, as we listen to the sounds of Walden Pond. Back after the news, here and now. On this Labor Day, we bring you the story of a man who literally rose above the rest of his co-workers in the textile mills of early 19th century America to become the nation's first daredevil. Our narrator is Nate DeMayo.
There once was a man from Pawtucket. His name was Sam Patch. And when he was a little kid, he did what most little kids in Pawtucket, Rhode Island did in the early 1800s. He went to work. 6 days a week in the textile mills, 12 hours a day in the winter, 14 or 16 in the haze and swelter of the summer. And when Sam Patch was 7 or 8, he did what some of the men in the mill did. On his break, little Sam would follow them up to the top of the high bluffs by the waterfall that powered the mill. And he'd jump. He'd leap out over the rocks that could break your legs and plummet down into that one spot in the river that was deep enough that you wouldn't break your neck. And for those few seconds, falling through the air, and cutting through the cold churn of the Blackstone River, he'd be free of the mill. And then he'd swim to shore and dry off and go back to finish out the day and the lifetime that lay ahead of him inside. Soon, Sam's favorite escape became the favorite escape of most of the other workers. They wouldn't jump themselves. They'd sit down by the riverbank and eat their lunch and watch him do it. And Sam Patch found his calling in falling. In 1827, he had been working in the mills for a decade and a half. He was 20. On September 30th, a crowd in the hundreds watched him plummet 70 feet from the top of Passaic Falls in Paterson, New Jersey, where he was working at the time. The next day, the papers dubbed him the New Jersey Jumper, and Sam left the mills behind for good. For 2 years, Sam patched toward the northeast. He jumped off flagpoles, off factory roofs, off ship's masts. If you could drum up a crowd and some cash and you had access to something really tall, Sam Patch would totally jump off of it. In the fall of 1829, he climbed up onto a platform 125 feet above the Niagara River in the midst of Niagara Falls and stepped off. He swam to shore, waved up to the 10,000 spectators roaring their appreciation up top. Men admired him. Women adored him. Parents worried their children would want to be him. And America demanded more. They wanted more spectacular leaps, more danger. They wanted more from the man who had come from nothing, the man who had toiled in the same mills that they had and found a way out, the man who was once mired in the drudgery of an all-too-familiar existence and had literally risen above it. But one can only climb so high. Flyers went up in Rochester, New York during the week of November 7th, 1829. At 2 o'clock that Friday, the 13th, Sam Patch was going to make his final leap. He was retiring. He had taken his odd discipline as far as he could, as far as anyone ever could. That cold Friday afternoon in November, Sam Patch clambered out onto a slippery ledge in the middle of a waterfall, 99 feet above the Genesee River. He got up to his feet and looked out at the crowd. 8,000 people had left their looms and machines at the mills and factories to cheer on one of their own. He shouted something down to them, though his words were lost in the roar of the waterfall. And he leapt and disappeared into the river below. And when he didn't come up, when he didn't appear on shore with a wave and a bow for the crowd and a wink for the ladies, people refused to believe it wasn't part of the show. They thought it was a brilliant scheme. He'd show up next year, back from the dead, for another leap. Even months later, when a farmer, some miles from the city, found Sam's body in a frozen stream running through his pasture, people refused to believe that their hero was gone. The 19th century Evel Knievel turned 19th century Elvis. People would say they were sure he was alive, just sure they saw him walking through Cleveland, or leaping alone by moonlight into the Mississippi, or they had caught a glimpse of him while they were sitting at their looms. He had walked out of the front door of their mill and didn't look back.
Our story on showman Sam Patch was produced by Nate DeMeo. To hear more of Nate's wonderful profiles of some of history's lesser-known characters, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds, with a look at whether texting is good or bad for literacy and kids, Here and Now. As texters head back to school, let's revisit a conversation we had with the preeminent linguist David Crystal to pose the question, does texting harm literacy? Some people call text messaging slanguage or a digital virus because vowels and punctuation are missing, and numbers pop up where a letter should be. Don't you just hate, H-8, that? But in Japan, text messaging is a literary form. People compose and read novels on their cell phones. David Crystal is the author of many books about language, including the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Language and Words, Words, Words. We spoke with him when his book, Texting, The Great Debate, came out. That's TXTING, the GR8DB8. And I asked him then if he thought texting was a new language.
No, it's not a new language as such. I know people get the impression from all the abbreviations and everything that something very new is going on here. When you actually look at all the messages that get sent, do you know, less than 10% of the words that are in texts actually are abbreviated. And although the kids are doing it quite a lot, when adults text to each other, they don't abbreviate much at all. And remember that most texts out in cyberspace these days are between adults, between organizations and adults. The stock exchange telling its people about the latest stocks, universities telling people, beware, there's a storm coming up, and so don't come in today. The kids, of course, are coming along and want to think this is really cool stuff, and so they introduce these abbreviations, but even they don't use them that much, because if you abbreviate everything, your message quickly becomes unintelligible.
Well, you include two comments in the book. John Humphreys of the Daily Mail wrote that texters are vandals, doing to our language what Genghis Khan did to his neighbors 800 years ago. And John Sutherland writes in The Guardian that texting is bleak, bald, sad shorthand, which masks dyslexia, poor spelling, and mental laziness. Yikes.
Wow, yes, that was strong, wasn't it? But you know, it's a moral panic that has no basis in fact. People think that texting is full of abbreviations. No, it isn't. People think that these abbreviations are new. They're not new. Abbreviations like C for C and U for U, they've been around for decades, for 100 years. Queen Victoria used to play games abbreviating words in this way.
These single word, you know, C for S-E-E, texts are called rebuses, we understand, and they go back quite a ways.
They go well back. I mean, you can get rebuses right back in Egyptian hieroglyphics. But in English, the term comes into the language in the 17th century and became really quite a playful way of expressing things. I don't know whether you ever had games like this in the States, but in the UK, you used to get these Christmas books, you know, full of cartoon characters and so on. And these annuals would often have a puzzle. And do you know this one, Robin? If I were to put before you the a capital Y...
I'm going to ask people to just get their pens out because we'll want people to write this down. So go ahead.
So write down a Y, another capital Y, a letter U, a letter R, another Y, another U, and another B. then the letter I, and then the letter C, and then the letter U, and the letter R, and then another Y, and then another Y, and then number 4,
mm-hmm.
and then the word me. And that used to be a sort of puzzle in books, you see, and you had to work it out by reading it like this. Two Y's you are, two Y's you be, I see you are, two Y's for me.
I love that.
And that goes back 100 years, you see. So there isn't that much new about texting from that point of view, is there?
You also write that IOU is from 1618, you know, so
sure.
This isn't new. Remind us, for those who haven't text messaged lately, remind us of what some of the words are. I mean, we mentioned LOL, laugh out loud, and 8 for, you know, H8 would be hate. But what are some others?
Well, the abbreviations are not as important as you might think. I mean, we can certainly list lots of them, like BRB, be right back. And all languages do them. In German, for instance, somebody might write Gute Nacht, Nacht for night, meaning N with an 8 after it, you see, because Acht is 8 in German. Now, different languages use these things in different ways. And interestingly, you start to find dialects of text messaging emerging then.
Well, another thing that's happening, we understand that abbreviated text messaging started because the early cell phones had some rudimentary technology. We all know, if you still have, as I do, the keypads that have 3 or 4 letters on each number, you have to press in to get the letter. And it was easier to just shorten some of the words than try to spell words that way. But now cell phones have text software that if you hit a letter, it will remember the word. You know, you don't have to spell out a whole word. So people are less likely to abbreviate.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's so difficult to predict the future in this sort of game, isn't it? You know, 10 years ago, one could hardly have predicted this. And in 10 years' time, what will have happened to text messaging? It may be just an effect of the moment, more or less.
Really?
Yeah, given that the technology is developing so rapidly. But, you know, there is an important thing about abbreviation, and that is, you know, a lot of people find it very, very cool way of communicating. And so they start to play with it and to develop all sorts of creative uses, which are actually quite tricky to put into the text message sometimes. You know, I remember noticing when the thing first came out in the UK, people would have text messaging poetry competitions, you know, write a poem within 160 characters. It's a bit like Japanese haikus in a way, you know, the discipline makes you really think more sharply and you can produce some stunning stuff.
I'm looking at a poem from Norman Silver, the first couple of words. Language, L-A-N-G-W-I-J, is highly infectious. H-I-L-Y, children the world over, O-V-A, catch it, from parents, P-A-R-E-N-C-E, by word of mouth.
What's happened here is that a text poet like Norman Silver, having seen the sorts of abbreviations that are used in cell phones, then decides to set up a whole published genre in a book in which they're all used. So he uses actually quite long poems in his book.
Mm.
And the same point applies to the Japanese novels that you were mentioning earlier on. Although they started on cell phones and people would send a chapter a day down to the phone user, now, of course, a lot of these things have been published as books.
So do you think, I mean, is it a problem, though, that young people in particular may be growing up thinking that the letters N and E spell A-N-Y, any? Or
no, because in order to do that, you must already know what the normal spelling is. You see, you can't leave letters out of words unless you know they're there in the first place.
Hmm.
Now, people are concerned about literacy standards these days. And one of the big things about literacy is people are always saying, the more you read and the more you write, the better your literacy is going to be. Now, texting is a perfect example where you can read and write, sometimes abbreviated, sometimes not. And the more you read and write, do you know what the results are showing? The better your literacy scores. And it isn't surprising, really, when you think that kids are getting far more experience of literacy using their cell phone than they might ever have had before.
Welcome back to Here and Now. In Joyce Maynard's new novel, Labor Day, Henry is a 13-year-old at the end of a lonely summer. His parents are divorced. His mother, Adele, can barely bring herself to leave the house. His father has built a new family with his second wife, Marjorie, and except for picking up Henry for a once-a-week second family dinner, he's out of the picture. But one Labor Day weekend, Henry brings home Frank, a wounded convict escaped from the local prison. And over the next few days, Henry, Frank, and Adele form their own quasi-family.
He drove. She sat next to him. I sat in the back seat that we'd never used as long as I could remember. This is how it is in a regular family, I thought. The mom, the dad, the kid. This was how my father liked to think we were when he and Marjorie and his new kids came to pick me up, except on those nights all I wanted was to have it be over, where now having it be over was what I dreaded. I could only see the back of her head, but I knew if I could see my mother's face, she'd have that expression I was so unfamiliar with, like she was happy.
Ah, but can it last? The law is looking for Frank. It's a story of a certain kind of single-parent family that may seem familiar to a lot of people, and we welcome author Joyce Maynard, who joins us from KQED in San Francisco, to talk about this fictional family and a little bit about her own, which she's written about recently. And Joyce, Labor Day is set in New Hampshire, where you live for a time.
For many, many years, right. The first 40 of my life. And I was a single mother in New Hampshire. I'm not this woman, but I think a lot of the themes that I explore in the book, one of them being the loneliness of that life and a certain kind of longing were ones that I was not unacquainted with.
Well, and you tell the story through a 13-year-old boy. How'd you find that voice?
Well, I raised a couple of them, but a deeper answer to that question goes beyond my own personal experience raising sons, and that is I've all my life felt very connected to the experience of young people, my own adolescence, for starters. This is a book really that explores a boy just on the verge of his sexuality, and he's exploring his own sexuality, but he's also witnessing with excruciating intimacy, because his room backs on his mother's, the very passionate relationship between his mother and this unlikely partner.
And prior to that, it was, as the very first sentence tells us, it was just the two of us, my mother and me, after my father left. There are a lot of families in that situation, this sort of huddled group moving forward, kids taking on different roles.
And having this dream of the kind of family life that, you know, that we have all been shown on television or wherever in other people's lives and long for.
And Henry, he's willing to sort of like blur his eyes because Frank is obviously an escaped convict. It's all over the news. He's bleeding from his wounds. And yet he's gentle with Henry's mother. He cooks.
You know, what I've said in my own life, and I think this part is present in this story, was that if you're out in the world for any length of time, you're very familiar with the phenomenon of somebody who looks like a good guy and turns out to be a bad guy. And this novel explores the corollary of somebody who looks like, definitely, he's going to be a bad guy. And perhaps he will turn out to be a very good guy.
Yeah. But it's also about how you strike that balance between, as an adult, finding your own happiness, because, in fact, that will make your children happier, but also doing the right thing by your kids.
And who takes care of whom, you know?
Yeah.
This is very much the story of a boy who feels enormously responsible for his mother.
So when Frank comes, he's more than ready.
He's off duty in some way. He sees his mother being happy. And I think, you know, parents feel responsible for their children's happiness. Children too often feel responsible for their parents' happiness.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned your own children. In the book, you thank them. But your you thank your firstborn, Audrey, in particular. Now, you wrote a modern love column recently about her in the New York Times.
With her permission, I have to add.
That's
crucially important when writing about one's children.
Well, in this case in particular, because you admit that post 9/11, you hadn't heard from her for a while. She was volunteering with a group in the Dominican Republic. You were worried. So worried, and I'm skipping ahead in the story, and we'll link to it at our website.
Mm-hmm.
But so worried that you broke into her email account and read her email.
I did. My actions came out of love for my daughter, who was then in her 20s, of course, but also it was a violation. It was a violation of her privacy, that impulse that parents have to protect. And the terrifying truth is that when your children leave home and go out into the world, and all three of mine now have, you can't protect them anymore.
Because what you discovered is that her then-boyfriend had tested positive for HIV. She hadn't yet and didn't know if she would down the road. So you have now this agonizing information because you broke in and you can't tell her you have it. Later, she told you of her own free will. She told you what she'd been going through. But you had that information. So now, Missy, you know, you had it and you had to figure out what
you opened Pandora's box.
Right.
And it doesn't make everything okay. Knowledge does not set you free in this case. It was an agonizing thing.
Did you ever think, okay, I have this information. I'm going to go act on it. I'm your mother.
Yes.
I'm going to go and I'm going to say, and why didn't you?
I don't think that my daughter at age 22 would have been ready to forgive and understand my actions. I think many times our children, I know the moment that I came to understand my mother so much better was when I became a mother myself. And my daughter is not that yet. And so she does not know that terror clutching at your gut. It's not that I wanted her to, you know, sort of like me at that moment, but I don't think that it would have been effective. I had to step back and let her make her way home.
Yeah.
Hardest thing to do. Hardest thing, I think it's the hardest thing I ever did as a parent.
Well, we should say that your daughter is HIV-free. Her now former boyfriend is also doing well. You did eventually tell her that you had broken into her email, and she's forgiven you. But you also talk in that Modern Love column about how violated you felt when your mom looked in your diary when you were young. And that reminded us, and it's ancient history now, but you are the young woman who famously at the age of 18 was featured on the cover of the Sunday New York Times magazine because of an essay you'd written. And you were then summoned to New Hampshire by the much older author J.D. Salinger. I think your mother even put you on the bus. And you've written about the question that raises, you know, how could a mother do that? So I'm wondering, is there a parenting thing going on for you as well?
Well, yes. I think, you know, I adored my mother, but I don't attempt to replicate the kind of parenting that she did. You know, the mother in this book is a terribly flawed mother. And I think it's part of what I like to explore in my work that, you know, the myth that because somebody is all grown up, they kind of know how to do it. They are in possession of the rule book. I'm still waiting for the rule book. When I wrote this book, my last few books had not sold well, and agents who read it said, you know, I don't think we can help you. You know, it was that old story that you referred to. Everybody knew that story, and that was who I was in the eyes of many. And so this agent, I went to a new agent, started over, all over again. He said, you know what, I love this book, but this is what we're going to do. We're going to submit this book anonymously. And evidently, a little buzz, a big buzz was created. It was a gossip column item in last fall in New York that this had clearly been written by some hot, new, young, male first novelist. In fact, there was speculation that it was the actor James Franco for some reason. I loved it. It was a sort of a last laugh for 54-year-old women everywhere. And I'm proud to have my name on that book. I am many things besides that girl who had, you know, one story when she was 18. I have many now, and this is one that I'm very proud to tell.
That's Joyce Maynard. Her new novel is Labor Day, and we'll also link you to her Modern Love column about the true life story of her experience with her daughter's email. Joyce, thanks as always. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise.